we sit on a Wednesday afternoon in the Showcase Studio, the Allstate Showcase Studio. So thanks for tuning in for that. We're going to talk to Frank Sennett a little bit later, Frank from Crane Chicago Business. And, well, you know, he's always had a thing. He wants to be in the movies. And there's a... there's a piece in Crane's about how much money Illinois makes when with movie and TV production. You've got Chicago Fire and all of that here. But Georgia, the state of Georgia, just crushes Illinois.
But what about Toronto, where so much is made? And every once in a while, you see something a little bit Canadian, like a Tim Hortons paper cup or something like that.
Well, I think these are U.S. cities. So the piece looks at what's done as far as incentivizing in Georgia compared to what we do here in Illinois. So we'll talk to Frank about that.
Devil went down to Georgia.
Atlanta side. I'm watching that series Atlanta now on FX. You should check it out.
Introduce me so they'll know who's throwing in these snide comments.
Terry Savage is here, but I can't hold her back. Wait, Christopher Matthews from Axios will be along as well. And you'll like this, Terry. There's a program in South Carolina because their unemployment rate now is so low that employers are begging for workers that they've stepped up the convict, literally not ex-con, but convict training to get people like that out of prison and into jobs right away. So that could be a great program where it's a win-win. Employers get employees, and guys who can't usually find a job because of a record are maybe turning their life around.
You're not talking about the chain gangs of old.
No,
we're not talking about highway construction.
No.
All
okay,
right.
But Terry Savage is here, and I'm sorry we need to devote all of our attention to you. Read more
yes,
from her
you.
At terrysavage.com. And, well, let's just start on Wall Street. What's up with Goldman Sachs?
Well, first of all, what's up with the market? Two interday highs. From both the
that's
S&P
not even news anymore.
SDX.
We're used to that.
Yeah, that's just same old, same old. So interesting story about the fact that Goldman Sachs, I mean, what a big headline, because Goldman's the big dog on the street that everybody loves to hate. And for the first time in years, Goldman is not the trading champ. Morgan Stanley has, quote, dethroned them. And for the last two quarters, their performance in fixed income and commodities and equities, they've made some bad calls. And their trading desk, which provides a majority, I mean, it's not really a partnership, but it is a partnership.
Sure.
And the trading desk provides their internal revenues. It's not commissions on stuff they sell you so much, but investment banking fees, but mainly the trading desk. Now, think about this. That shows you the value of one person, Gary Cohn.
Oh, you think that's
left
it, right?
Two quarters ago as the head guy at Goldman in terms of trading to join the Trump administration. So this is what happened to Goldman without him.
And you think it is Gary Cohn?
Absolutely.
No kidding. Okay.
Oh, yeah. No. I've heard him speak. I can't say that I know him, but I've heard him speak. He was the leader, and when he left... The ship went awry.
So do you think any of those Goldman traders will end up living with their parents one day?
You know, every other generation we get one of those moments.
There's a study out today from Trulia, which is a real estate, right?
Exactly.
They look at real estate. And they talked about, and you know, we've talked about this, everyone has, about how more and more people are living with their parents or multi-generational homes. Okay, so they did sort of a study on it. And let me just give you a few numbers. In 2014, well, let's start backwards. In 1980, 12% of Americans lived in a multi-generational home. Now, that's not parents and children.
No, but it's grandma.
These are two adult generations, uh-huh. So adult children and children. So 1980, 12%, 27.5 million. In 2009, that number was up to 17%, 42.4 million. And in 2014, the last year for the numbers, 60.6 million or 19%, 20% of the U.S. population is living in a multi-generational adult home.
Now, when do you count college graduates returning home to live in the basement because they couldn't get a job? Because that's about when it started happening. And they would be considered an adult generation at
that
point.
Yeah, I think you do. You don't count them as students, but I think you count them when they're out. Among Americans aged 25 to 29 in 2014, what percentage do you think were in a multi-generational home? 25 to 29.
Oh, I don't know, maybe 15, 16%?
31%. One in three kids or young adults in their 20s outside of college were living in a multi-generational home. That's now become the way we live. Yeah.
So, as I recall, the Trulia study, I just saw the headline, said there's a lot of money to be made if the parents would just charge their children rent, which seems like a right idea.
Let's get there, but I want to give you one more statistic, because they also say, Trulia says, it's not just where we are economically, it's where we are populationally. What's the word?
Ethnically, the demographics?
Where we are ethnically, because the Asian population and Hispanic population are growing disproportionate to the white population, and those two groups are more likely to have multi-generational homes than white Americans.
The nicest way to put that is they have more respect for their elders.
They take care
of them. Elder now, right. I can say that.
Okay, so yeah, so the crux of it is, if you're an older person and you've got all these rooms empty, they've got some numbers for how many rooms are empty, rent them out.
Now, I have to tell you something. Over many years, you know, I respond to questions on my blog, and before that I used to take phone calls when I was on TV all the time. I have given this advice many times. I think I noticed about 20 years ago that the crisis point is women divorced, age 62, divorced or widowed or on their own for some reason, wanting to stay in their own homes. Again, this is before the financial crisis, and yet not being able to make the rising property tax payments and find the jobs. They were losing jobs, women in their 60s. I often thought, I wish I could start a whole counseling thing for just that group. But many times I would say, do you realize your kids are off to college? But the problem is finding someone you'd let live in your home. Well, if you're not talking about your own kid paying a little bit of rent, find someone through your church or through an organization. I think the next Uber, and it's not talking about Airbnb, but maybe it's a derivative, because that seems to where it was way before Airbnb. I would never have thought of letting a stranger just come and have a room in my
stay
house.
Stay in your house.
But now we've seemed to have gotten used to it. And I think that's the solution for many women who want to stay in their homes.
Isn't it interesting that we are hypersensitive to crime and terror, and we're fearful? I think we're fearful in so many ways now, right? There's just some berries in here, and a couple of people said, I'm not touching those. Pesticides are going to kill me. I'm not going to eat them. So there are so many things we're afraid of. And yet, on the other hand, we're opening up in so many different ways.
We get in a car with a stranger.
Yeah.
The first time a friend of mine, Joan Esposito, you remember,
sure,
news anchor,
yeah.
She got in a car to go out to her house in the suburbs after dinner one night. It was an Uber X. It wasn't an Uber, you know, it wasn't a taxi.
Right.
And I said, but you don't even know who that is driving.
And it's the way we work.
I remember being shot.
Having people spending the night in your house with
Whoa.
Them. With
Whoa.
Them. So that's kind of a...
Or leave them alone in your house for a weekend. But maybe that's going to be a solution for the baby boomer generation of older people. There are just so when I want you, if you're hearing this, you think about this. There are as many people who don't own a home or who have to get out of their homes for one reason or another as you. Now, we're talking about healthy, able-bodied, active people. The senior lifestyle community has grown to accommodate those, so that's probably a better solution. But if for some reason or another you want to maintain your home, renting out your guest room or your kid's room.
Aren't you describing sort of the boarding houses of the 50s?
Yeah, I guess that's exactly, or of the 30s in the Depression era.
I wonder if there'd be zoning issues, though, too.
Well, you know what?
Just don't
let
tell them.
Let Airbnb fight that battle. This is something else.
That's Terry Savage. You can read from her at terrysavage.com. Her latest column is about student loan debt and how to avoid scams. We'll talk about that. Frank Sennett will be along a little bit later to talk about what's new in Crane Chicago business, and specifically at Willis Tower as well. Right now we're talking to Terry Savage about student debt. And some of the numbers, I think that in the past decade, student debt has increased 250%. It's something I know in my house with a couple of college students. And you know, let me tell you this, Terry, true story. So my daughter, Emma, who's very industrious, she went over all of her loan statements a week or so ago, looked at what she was facing, and then right away offered to paint our garage for $500.
It can be very motivating, or it can be very intimidating. We now owe more. $1.3 trillion on student loans, more than credit card debt, more than car loan debt. And what we have learned in the last couple of years is that very few people are getting the right information on how to repay.
Isn't just people ripping you off, right?
Oh, no,
these are the people supposed to help you.
Exactly. So I have to credit Lisa Madigan's office, because not only for Illinois, but she's led the group of state's attorneys general in dealing with this issue. And if you go to illinoisattorneygeneral.gov, in fact, if you read the column that was just posted at terrysavage.com, there's about a half a dozen great helpful websites, starting off with the Illinois Attorney General's information on student loans. She's filed suit against a lot of these people that want you to pay a fee up front. First of all, don't pay any fees up front to help you figure out how to deal with your student loans. That in itself is a scam. But sadly, she and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau have filed suit against Navient, which is the largest official student loan servicer. When I posted this column, I got a quick response from Navient. They said, "We're defending this strongly in court." I said, "Okay, when it's all over, I'll report that." But both you and the Attorney General are being sued for not giving good advice, not telling people what their programs are that could reduce their payments.
Okay, so let's back this up a little bit. So Navient, it's their job to They service the loans, right?
Yeah, they're the the largest number of people make their loan payments.
And so they make money by...
Yeah. Well, now there are a bunch of those companies. Now there's even, let's not get off on this, but a couple of things are going on the sidelines. First of all, the Trump administration or someone in that area has proposed, let's just consolidate it all in one loan provider. Well, I'm not sure they're going to be watching out for them. But that's one proposal. Another thing that's going on out there is a lot of students who took out loans from for-profit colleges, trade schools, computer schools, beauty schools, and the loans were sold, and they're now being harassed by debt collectors. It's been found out that the paperwork isn't. It's like the mortgage, subprime mortgages. Right. The paperwork isn't there, and if you fight those demands to collect, especially when you went to a school that never got you a job, they may not have had the paperwork, so you may get your loan debt estimated that $5 billion worth of loan debt's questionable now. But for all of you, especially now, who are thinking I've graduated, it's time to start repaying my loans. First of all, you're college graduates. Pay attention to this process. Federal student loans, go to the federal government website, National Student Loan, nslds.ed.gov. It's in the column. It's their database. There's a phone number in the column. You'll get a list of all your federal student loans. And then if you have private loans, you know, there's not much you can do about those. But if you do have a job, you could probably refinance them at SoFi.com. Let me give you one more website. StudentAid, StudentAid.ed.gov. On that homepage, there's a click on how to repay your loans. There are all kinds of tools and estimator tools. Don't count on your loan servicer to tell you about deferment, forbearance, income-based repayment plans, paying on time for 10 years, and qualifying jobs that gets your loan forgiven. This is your first graduate job. Figure out your student loans and don't get scammed.
I like that you write in the column at terrysavage.com. You write, look, you're a college graduate. You can handle this. So you're telling me that if someone offers for a fee...
No, don't do that. That's
no
the
matter
first
what.
Sign of a rip. No, you do not. There are... Keep this column. Print it out. Cut it out. Email it. You can email it right to your friends. This is important. Don't be
really,
falling for
I'm
going
to email
scams.
It to my refrigerator door.
Email it to your refrigerator. Well, your refrigerator door is probably a smart refrigerator.
Right. Not so much, but...
With all this rest of it. I think this... I believe, and I've said for many years, that student loan debt is the next housing crisis. But because even beyond that, even beyond these practical tips I have in this column, you think about it, it's really a form of generation warfare. We have enticed the government, I should say, with easy money, students into getting educations that don't necessarily qualify from jobs to repay those loans. And if the young gal who called me up and wanted me to tell her mother which type of student loan she should take, when I told her, no, you have to stay and live at home for two more years and not take out a student loan, I wish I could find her. Please don't burden yourself with this kind of debt. Not until your third and fourth years of school, when you know where you're going and what the education's for.
That's Terry Savage. Check out the column and you'll have all the websites, phone numbers, and the advice at terrysavage.com. All right, we'll see you next week.
Absolutely.
Frank Sennett is on a phone line from Crane Chicago Business. He joins us on Wednesdays to talk about what's what. Frank, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. But I don't know if you heard Kim during her newscast that during the sports specifically. Did you hear her sports? Did anything jump out at you?
Well, we got a little Cubs action going on.
Yeah,
little,
she said, and she said it too. She said Mike Montgomery had a no-hitter in the fifth inning.
But now he doesn't.
Yeah, that's right, Kim. That's why we're talking to you.
Oh, sorry. Sorry to...
Kim broke the tradition, and about 30 seconds later, the Braves got a hit. Not on the board yet, but that's okay, Kim. Just put that one down. Remember it for next time.
There's no superstition in baseball at all.
You're a Braves fan, aren't you?
I am. I grew up in Montana, and that was all we had on cable. We didn't have GN, and then I became a Cubs fan when I moved to Chicago.
That's a funny sentence. I am a Braves fan. I grew up in Montana. But I guess that makes sense because they were the first superstation with Ted Turner and all that.
Yes.
Yeah. So you'd watch them make the playoffs year after year and not really do anything about it.
No, when I was a kid, because you and I are contemporary, Steve, they were terrible. I was like a fan for 10, 12 years before they started to get good. And then they would make the playoffs and then crap out.
Yeah, but they would make the playoffs, which is not too shabby. It wasn't happening here. Okay, let's stay in Georgia while we're at it then, or go to Georgia. There's a piece by Lisa Bertagnoli. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah.
Bertagnoli,
yeah.
About how much Illinois brings in when it comes to film revenue, TV revenue, and it's a pretty penny. But then she compares it to Georgia, and there's a little shine goes off of Abe Lincoln's nose. We're not doing nearly as well as Georgia.
Right. So we would, you'd think, rank behind California and New York in film production. After all, we've got Dick Wolf with the Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, Chicago Med, and soon to be Chicago Radio, hopefully with me and you.
Right.
In the year that ended July 1st, Chicago did about $500 million in film production. But Georgia incentivizes so much with their tax giveaways, their tax breaks, that they are number three behind California and Illinois. And the TV and film producers spent $2.7 billion in Georgia last year. So it's more than five times what they spent in Illinois. So they're outclassing us. Marvel opened an office there, for goodness sake.
Well, but we've got a lot. We've got a great presence here, right? We've got that outfit out on the west side. I don't have the name in front of me.
CineSpace, right?
CineSpace, right. I had those guys on last year. That's a great year-round working studio. I guess maybe the question I'm getting at is the incentive package that Georgia offers so steep that it's maybe not worth it for us here? I mean, are they giving away the store just to get their name on the credits?
Yeah, that's what people in the State House are saying. They're saying our tax credits in Illinois are aimed at creating jobs in Illinois, and the ones in Georgia, they'll give tax write-offs for like Tom Cruise's salary, whereas in Illinois, it's capped at $100,000 salary for tax breaks. And it incentivizes just the jobs that are created in the state. And it's doing quite well. It'll expire in 2021, but the main plan is to renew that early. So with the long lead time for feature films, that will still generate, good, decent returns.
Okay.
And Georgia, meanwhile, is giving away the store, basically.
But you said something there that's interesting, because you said it in a way that I hadn't thought of it. So in Georgia, everyone who gets paid by the movie company, they get the tax credit, right? So you mentioned Tom Cruise. So he comes in from California or Mars or wherever he's coming in from to act, and he gets this tax credit. If he were to make a movie in Chicago, he wouldn't get the tax credit, but the guys working on the set who make $100,000 or less would, right? They wouldn't have to live here, or would they have to live here?
Well, no, it's capped on Illinois jobs, people working in Illinois, but I think it can be temporary workers as well, but it's capped at $100,000. So, it's your carpenters, it's your lighting people, et cetera.
Okay. And so aside from that, then, if we're not going to catch Georgia, are we satisfied with where we are, or what can we do to make it a little better?
Yeah, I think from what Lisa's reporting, that basically the main thrust is to renew this current tax credit earlier than 2021 to capture a lot of the long lead stuff. But, I think we can always be doing better, probably by inviting producers out, that kind of thing, making it easier with some of the red tape in terms of setting up shoots, just making it as welcoming as possible. But I don't think we're going to see a lot more on the incentive front.
Have you seen Jamie Lee Curtis around town yet?
I have not. Is she in town?
Well, she's making the movie, I guess. What I read, Pages, starring Jamie Lee Curtis. Actually, someone did say they ran into her and her husband on Michigan Avenue maybe a couple of weeks ago. So it all comes true. All right, so Chicago Cops or Chicago Fire? Which is your show?
I'm going to Chicago Radio. They got to sign us up.
Right. I like that very much, and hopefully the ratings will continue to grow on that program. That's all we can hope for. I don't park downtown very often. My wife is much better at it than I am, fitting into those spots and everything. but she uses Spot Hero. And Spot Hero just came into a lot more money, right? They're only going to get bigger. And I think they are, if they haven't become, they will be the way we park in the future.
Yeah, I've used it a few times. And, you know, hotels that have some extra valet spaces, et cetera, will, you know, offer some really good deals. So you can park cheaply downtown if you use it, at off-peak times. And they just raised another $30 million in valuation. In capital to put their valuation high enough that they should have sustainable funding all the way through profitability. They recently bought their rival Parking Panda as well, and they've about tripled their employees base to 200.
And they're competing what with ParkWiz? Is that the other big one?
Yeah, and it just seems like Spot Hero is kind of on a roll right now.
You know what I like, or what I'm interested in, is both of those, ParkWiz and Spot Hero. I think they want to become, you know, like when you get your TV, a new TV, and you've got different apps loaded on it, or an iPhone with apps on it, right? They're after becoming sort of kind of built in or an app on new cars.
Yeah, almost like a utility. Yeah. And they're in 50 cities right now, and they're going to expand with this new funding. So pretty much if you live in a city, it would make sense to have it installed in your heads-up navigation display, and, you know, just use a voice command and find me a cheap parking space.
All right, one more then. Is it GATX or GATX? It's GATX, isn't it, the rail company?
Yeah, GATX is now going to go into the newly refurbished, formerly Sears Tower, now Willis Tower. There's been a $500 million renovation, new, lounges for employees in the building and new amenities in the restaurants, et cetera. And it seems to be paying off for Blackstone. Blackstone purchased it recently and just put a lot of money into making it a blue chip building. And they're at 90% leased out, and they just got the GATX headquarters. So it seems like a very smart play for them.
I know GATX is downsizing a little bit, but it's a raid, isn't it? Blackstone just sort of raided the building across the street.
Yeah, exactly. They're kitty corner. And so GATX, probably just going to get all their employees to grab one box each and walk across the street. That'd be the way I'd do it.
Maybe they'll set up a human train to get the things across from one to the other. Okay, that's enough of that. Frank Sennett, good to talk to you. We'll do it again next week.
Thank you, Steve.
Orion Samuelson, I hope you're still there. I wanted to talk a little bit more about what you were talking about with the crops. You know, I live in Lake County, and we're dealing with a lot of rain there and a lot of flooding,
right.
And you tend to sometimes forget to look at the bigger picture. So tell me again, they're worried about precipitation in the Midwest?
They're worried about the lack of precipitation and the heat during what's called the corn pollination season, which is basically during the month of July, and then we get into the soybean make-or-break crop in August, and that depends a lot on rainfall. But the showers have been so spotty, because you'll get 7-8 inches, and maybe 10 miles away you'll get nothing. And the spring wheat crop in the Dakotas and Montana probably going to be at a 15-year low because of weather. So, yeah, you do have to look at the big picture. It can't just look at your cornfield.
Okay, this is going to sound like a really stupid question, so bear with me.
There are no stupid questions.
Well, so I know that modifications in crops have helped them deal with different pests and things like that, in weeds and all of that. Has the improvement in the seed helped them deal with drought as well? Has it made them more drought tolerant?
It's an interesting question, because Monsanto now for the past 4 or 5 years has been working on plants that can make it on less rainfall. And even in drought areas, they're making progress, but it's not a fast conversion like it was on the insecticides and the pesticides. But yes, that's a good question. They're working on it, and it'll take time, but I'm guessing we'll come up with plants that'll survive and thrive on less water than they're currently getting.
Never no water altogether, but right, I would imagine that's the sort of thing that is within grasp in one way or another.
I think it is, yes.
So, I grew up, I shouldn't say that because I didn't do it that often, but walking the beans. or, you know, detasseling corn.
Detasseling corn.
And you tell people that now, you know, that you would sit on a corner and wait for some guy in a pickup to slow down, and you jump in the bed of a pickup and go out to the middle of a field and spend your day pulling weeds. A lot of people here don't quite get that. That's not done anymore at all, is it?
No. I don't think you're walking the bean field at all. And detasseling is now done by other means than by hand, which made a lot of money for kids your age at that time growing up.
Is it change if it's like, I want to say a vegetable crop. I don't know what's the right word for it, but, you know, if it's squash rather than rows of sweet corn, I mean, is it different in those fields?
Are you comparing sweet corn with field corn?
No. I'm comparing like a farmer's market vegetable, whether it's a patch of cucumbers, to rows of corn.
Rows of corn, that's a tough one to come up with because it varies so much across the country.
Right.
But we have increased the corn population per acre dramatically, because we used to have rows that were 30 inches wide. Now I think we're down to corn rows that are 16 to 20 inches wide, and that means you can almost double the amount of production as long as you take care of the fertility of the soil, because every corn plant takes fertility out of the soil, and you have to put that back.
All right. While we're on the farm, I'm going to ask you one more, because Louis Lazar was in last week, and we were talking about hamburger. The amount of hamburgers that we are eating, and the fact is that they are way, way down. And one of the things they blamed were the prices of beef. Are they still going up, or where are we with that?
No, the cattle prices have been not only leveling off but declining. In Arizona, we have several friends who are ranchers, one in particular who has 600 mother cows, and he is watching his price for those calves when they're ready to move into the feedlots barely at a break-even price, and some of them will be below break-even. So the price of beef at the meat counter should be coming down because we're getting more supplies of cattle. We'll get a report on Friday showing how many cattle we have on feed currently in the U.S. And we just don't translate a lower price for the animal to the meat counter at the supermarket as quickly as we should.
When's the last time you had a fried egg on a hamburger?
Oh, I would say about 8 months.
Oh, not bad. Okay. Well, listen, thanks for talking to us today. I appreciate it. We'll check in again tomorrow on the Business Lunch.
Anytime.